Good morning. I will call this informational hearing of the House Commerce Committee to order and ask Mr. Petrie to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Khadiza-Witoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr. Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney present.
Representative Dabney's present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Elkins present. Representative Haley.
Present.
Representative Haley present. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Cagle present. Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lee present. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lilly present. Representative Lislegard.
Representative Lislegard present.
Representative Lislegard present. Representative Lucero.
Lucero present.
Representative Lucero present. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Olson present. Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Farr present. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Rasmussen present. Representative Richardson.
Richardson present.
Representative Richardson present. Representative Tice is excused.
We do have a quorum, although because we are not taking any formal action today, a quorum isn't strictly speaking necessary. The sole item on our agenda today is House File 1492, which is a bill related to data consumer protections. We're hearing this bill on an informational basis during the interim because it is just an absolutely critical issue that Representative Elkins has been working on for some time, but he and I both thought it was a good time to get some public feedback and some discussion going about this bill as we look forward to the 2022 session. So with that, I will give the floor to Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pull up, share my screen here real quick. Presentation. So first, I have to get the presentation to a place where there we go. Okay, let's see what's okay. Can everybody see the slide? I'm not.
We can see it.
You can see it. Okay, I'll leave it. Sorry, my copy hasn't kicked in yet. Okay, I'm screen sharing. We're good. And there we go. That's better. Okay. So to kick off just a little bit about the provenance of the bill. Bills of this nature, most of them have their original roots with the European General Data Protection Regulation, which has been in effect in Europe, and many international companies are already complying with it. That spawned the first California Consumer Protection Act, which was hastily thrown together. One of the authors of that bill told me that it was written in about a week. Was the first, state level Consumer Data Privacy Act, and it in turn spawned a state of Washington bill authored by Washington State Senator Reuben Carlisle in 2020, Washington State Bill, Senate Bill 6281, upon which my consumer data privacy law from the last session, House File 3936, was drawn. This year, the voters in, late last year, last November, the California voters voted to replace the CCPA with the California Privacy Rights Act, the CPRA. And in response to the passage of that act, Senator Carlisle updated his bill framework. His bill this year is Washington Senate Bill 5062. And that bill has become a template for consumer data privacy bills in a number of states. In Virginia, House Bill 2307 passed earlier this year, and just this summer, Colorado passed its version, Senate Bill 190. So how this year's bill for me, House File 1492, is in that same mold. And in fact, Nathan Hopkins and Nonpartisan House Research has compared the Washington bill, the Virginia bill, and the Colorado bill with House File 1492, and has found actually very, very few substantive differences among these four bills. We'll talk about a few of the relatively minor ones, but one of the biggest things that I'm hearing from the business community in respect to these bills is that everybody pretty much agrees that in an ideal world, this topic would be taken up by Congress and dealt with the federal level. I certainly agree with that perspective as well. But all of those same people are also telling me that there's not a snowball's chance of hell of the current Congress taking a bill of this nature up and passing it anytime in the near future. And so, as is often the case these days, the states are serving as the laboratories of democracy. We're acting, but we are doing our best to make sure that that businesses don't end up with a 50-state hodgepodge of completely unrelated data privacy bills. We are trying to create a common framework that extends across as many states as possible to create as consistent a standard as we possibly can. So between now and when we reconvene on January 31st, we will be doing a much more in-depth comparison of these four bills or acts to make sure that we have as much consistency as possible among this collection of bills. It's not to say that we won't have some differences with them, but we'll be trying very hard to make sure that any differences don't have a cost impact on business. They would be of the nature of clarifications of the language. So the consensus among people who are following this this issue closely is that while there may be minor differences among these bills as each one passes, there's some progress in the positive direction being made with each of them, some language from each of them that may be worthy of inclusion in this bill. And as most of you know, and there are over 60 people now in my email distribution list for stakeholders for this bill, I'm otherwise retired and I'm working about three or four main issues, this being one of them. Between now and January, this is pretty much all I'm doing. And my email box, my phone is always open. Any stakeholder can reach out to me at any time to be heard on their particular concerns. So looking at the written comments and speaking with many of you, I know what some of the contention points are. We'll be discussing some of them in a little more detail today. So for those the uninitiated, a collection of basic rights that are established by all of these bills. The first of them is characterized as the right to know. So you should basically a company ought to be able to tell you if it has your data, what data they have. It should allow you to see a copy and provide a copy of it to you and let you know if they've sold it. The right to correct is pretty straightforward. It's the right to have inaccuracies in the data that a company has collected about you corrected. The right to deletion refers to the right to have your data deleted if it is no longer needed for its original purpose, has been unlawfully processed, or if you withdraw your consent or if it's required by law. And a perfect example of this came up with in a conversation with Senator Carlisle at a National Conference of State Legislators Primary Privacy Summit that was held last week. And Representative Scott, Representative Lucero, and Representative Nash were there for this conference as well. It was excellent. But the example that Senator Carlisle used was the case of, say, you have had a DNA test performed by a 23andMe or an Ancestry.com. Once the company has performed the test for you, provided you with the results, there's really no reason why they should need to keep the data around. You ought to have be able to request that once you've been provided with the service that you signed up for from one of those companies, that they delete your DNA data. Fourth is the right to restrict profiling. Companies would be restricted from making purely black box decisions about you related to important life opportunities like employment, healthcare, financial services, housing, et cetera, without, giving you the ability to question the results of that profiling and understand, provide you with a plain English understanding of why you are denied one of these rights, similar to the rights that we currently have for credit reporting under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Fourth is the right to restrict usage. You can tell a company to stop using your data if you believe that the data is inaccurate, its use is unlawful or unnecessary. And finally, and we'll probably talk about quite a bit about this today, the right to either, opt in or out of having your data used for targeted advertising in particular. And the point of, why is it important for us to pass a bill like this is that if you're the kind of geek like I am and you actually, read, the internet privacy statements that go with applications you use on the internet, you will know that you are now occasionally being seeing at the bottom of those statements that, oh, if you live in California or one of the other states that have passed this bill, then you have these additional rights. I want, Minnesota to be one of the states where you have these additional rights that we don't have right now because we have not passed a bill like this. So other basic requirements in the bill are, requiring transparency and accessibility. You ought to be able to read the privacy policy, and you ought to be able to communicate with the company, have prompt processing of your requests and appeals of decisions. Company should not be, collecting data about you that it does not need to process to do business with you, or be using it for extraneous purposes that are not related to the reason why you're doing business with that company. Company should have a responsibility to keep your data secure and private, and you should be able to have a reasonable expectation that your data is not going to be used for discriminatory purposes. Data protection assessments are required, and enforcement would be via the Attorney General. And the fiscal note for this bill is relatively modest. Attorney General's office is asking for two attorneys and an investigator. The startup cost for the first year would be estimated to be about $378,000, and then $278,000 in subsequent years. The scope of this, to be clear, because we have a lot of privacy laws already governing government in Minnesota, but this only covers private entities. So it categorizes companies that collect data from us as controllers, and companies that process data on behalf of controllers as processors. Anything related to government data is, of course, covered by the Minnesota Data Practices Act instead. There are size-based exemptions for small businesses. And industries that are governed by well-established federal laws would continue to be governed by those federal laws instead. So examples of that are, HIPAA and HITECH for healthcare, Gramsci-Wiley for finance, the Fair Credit Reporting Act for credit bureaus, and FERPA for education. So now that I have been in the Commerce Committee for 3 years, I know that individual industries are very, very particular about making sure that state laws are aligned with overlapping federal laws. And so I'm already getting feedback from some stakeholders requesting, tweaks in the language just to better align this bill with existing federal law. and that will be one of the issues that I expect to be working on over the next several months with stakeholders. And then facial recognition is a complicated enough subject that it's broken out into a separate bill. So right now, there's a bill, House File 1196, that deals specifically with facial recognition. And I think Representative Neuer may be working on a bill on this as well. So the likely points of contention we'll probably be talking about today in my conversations with stakeholders are the issue of the private right of action. The bill does rely solely on attorney general enforcement. It does not grant a right of private action right now. I do expect this issue to be raised. I intend to have a well-written amendment on this offered when the bill arrives at its second stop in judiciary and civil law. This is an issue that I'm personally not willing to fall on my sword on one way or the other. The main reason that the bill has not actually passed in the state of Washington itself is that they have not, the House and the Senate in Washington have not been able to come to an agreement over this issue, loggerheads. And this one issue has blocked the passage of the bill in the state of Washington. And I don't want that to happen here. The definition of a sale is emerging as a point of contention. In the original Washington bill that HF 1492 is based on, a sale occurs with the exchange of either money or any other kind of valuable consideration. That's pretty much basic contract law. But in the Virginia bill, a sale only occurs when there is an exchange of cash compensation, and barter exchanges are not covered in the Virginia bill. An example of why I'm disinclined to take the Virginia approach, which is far favored by most businesses, is I use the example of an application called Flow that many of the ladies may be familiar with. It Flow tracks very very personally sensitive reproductive information for women, and their privacy policy was very strict. The company has promised that they would never exchange their data anyway, but the FTC caught them providing data to Google Analytics and one other web analytics company as a processor in order to have those companies do basic marketing analysis of their internet data. And that's okay as long as it would be okay as long as, it was they were that those companies were bound by the same promises that Flow itself had made and then destroyed the data afterwards. But in exchange for some consideration, Flow allowed both Google Analytics and this other company to keep a copy of that very sensitive data to use without restriction. And that's wrong. And I don't think that and when we're trying to legislate on this, that we should exclude those kinds of situations simply because no cash was exchanged as part of the deal. Opt-in versus opt-out is generally in this area a very contentious topic. In the bill, the way it's written right now, and in all of these Washington model bills, there is an opt-in for what's considered sensitive personal information. So sensitive personal information includes things like any kind of personally identifying information, biometric data, precise locational data. So when it comes to those kinds of data, a company cannot use your data unless you are specifically opted in. So the default is that your data may not be used for targeted advertising. For all other kinds of non-sensitive data, there is an opt-out, so that there would be a presumption that the company could use the data.
appears we've had some technical difficulties. In particular, I am told that the power has gone out in Bloomington, where Representative Elkins is. So we will move forward to some testifiers while we hope that Representative Elkins is able to rejoin us. And so I'll ask Stacey Gray to go first. Ms. Gray, welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you so much. Shame to interrupt that great summary that Representative Elkins was providing. But happy to weigh in and help maybe help kick things off. So Stacey Gray, I'm a senior counsel with the Future of Privacy Forum in Washington, D.C. We are a nonpartisan think tank focused exclusively on commercial privacy issues in the United States and globally. And we've done a lot of research and work over the last few years on comparing different legislative approaches. For example, we published a robust comparison of the CCPA to the GDPR when the CCPA was first released and passed into law. So similarly, Representative Elkins had asked me to start us off with some sort of maybe high-level comparisons, points of observation in comparing HF 1492 to other legal approaches. So I can start off with just a couple of minutes of my observations on that front. I think the summary Representative Elkins was providing was probably the most useful sort of point to begin with. I agree with everything that was stated. HF 1492 incorporates, I would say, most or almost all of the requirements in the CCPA, as well as the new Virginia and Colorado laws, in a basically interoperable way. This is incredibly important. The interoperability piece is incredibly important, particularly with respect to less identifiable data collected through internet and mobile traffic. So things like, you know, just basic internet traffic where names are not associated with the information, but it's still considered personal information. The interoperability piece is very important because there are major compliance challenges with complying with different provisions for similar data across state lines. Going further than the CCPA and more in line with Virginia and Colorado, HF 1492 defines sensitive data specifically and requires a higher standard for that sensitive data, so robust affirmative consent for sensitive data. This is in line with traditional U.S. legal approaches. For example, the Federal Trade Commission recommended as early as 2012 that affirmative consent was the right model for these kinds of particular categories of high-risk data. Sometimes this approach garners some criticism, particularly in advertising and marketing, when the goal is to, for example, reach high-risk communities with affirmative outreach. And so you may hear some deliberation around that. But in general, this approach matches Virginia, matches Colorado, matches kind of longstanding norms in the United States. And in particular, the specific definition that HF 1492 has for affirmative consent is a very strong standard. It matches what the definition is in the General Data Protection Regulation. And I can definitely talk more about that if that's of interest. But we think that's a good thing. Couple of substantive differences. Probably the biggest substantive difference right now between HF 1492 and some other approaches is that unlike California and soon Colorado, HF 1492 does not require what's being called a globalized or a global opt-out. This means that although HF 1492 has very strong requirements for allowing consumers in Minnesota to opt out of sale, targeted advertising, and certain kinds of profiling, an individual in Minnesota would have to go specifically to each business, to each website, to each different company that may have their information and opt out specifically from that company's collection and data processing, usually by using a mechanism that company or business provides. Particularly with respect to online and mobile data, the number of companies that have such information can be very, very large. And as you can imagine, this can be burdensome. And so what has happened through California's Attorney General rulemaking and what has now been codified to eventually become law in Colorado is that companies there will be required to comply with global privacy preference settings that an individual can express through a browser setting or a plugin, for example, that would broadcast a privacy signal to each website or app that you go to, and the company would see it and be able to comply without that individual having to go through a specific mechanism, 100 times. That's the basic gist of it. There are, of course, some complications. It's even probably more important with this that there be interoperability between states, because you're talking about something inherently interstate. But that's a pretty big one, and I think you'll probably hear it from privacy advocates, the importance of such a requirement and a recommendation that Minnesota incorporate it. Another substantive difference, of course, is that in some states, Colorado and California, their consumer privacy bills have granted the Attorney General explicit rulemaking authority. That's tied to the global opt-out requirement in some cases, but not only. And I see Representative Elkins is back. Awesome. So I'll wrap it up. Attorney General rulemaking can be a great way to keep laws evergreen and comply and give businesses the guidance that they need to comply over time with evolving business practices and evolving technology. Hi, Representative Elkins. Just wrapping up with the note about Attorney General enforcement, and I can go on and on with some of this to the minor substantive differences between HF 1492 and some of the other proposals we've seen in the United States, but let me give it back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Gray. Representative Elkins, I see it looks like you're on your phone now, so I'm guessing we can't do the PowerPoint again, but if you have any remarks to make, that'd be good. You're muted at the moment.
Okay. No, the PowerPoint was just about done anyway. So power was going to cut out in the house. It was good that it cut out when it did. I was pretty much finished. So great, we're good.
Okay. Then our next testifier from the author is Jim Halpert. Mr. Halpert.
Thank you very much. I apologize. For some reason, I used WebEx before this, and it is preventing me from connecting by video, but I very much appreciate Representative Elkins' invitation to testify, and I will try to be brief. In general, I agree with Ms. Gray's testimony, but I'm going to emphasize a few ways, and I think this bill is overall and generally would be a major win for consumers in Minnesota. I do want to emphasize several places where the bill would go beyond GDPR and be different from Virginia and Colorado in ways that I think would be good to tweak before it moves forward to avoid divergence of requirements. The first is that definition of sale, which includes value that is receive that is different than a sale. It has real implications in the bill for loyalty programs. If you look at lines 14.12 to 14.14, there's a broad prohibition against selling personal data to a third-party controller as part of a loyalty program. And 14.12 says that the third party that uses the data has to use the data only for purposes of facilitating the benefit to which the consumer is entitled and may not retain or otherwise use or disclose the personal data for any other purpose. This becomes a substantive restriction and bar on a broad range of loyalty programs where in exchange for providing the benefit, for example, the hotel chain may receive the data as part of Delta's frequent flyer mile program, they would be prohibited from using that data at all. And this is a degree of regulation that is very, very odd in the U.S. It made its way into the Carlisle bill at the ask of a few interests, but it would functionally, if the definition of sale is broader than actual sale, this would mean that a whole bunch of loyalty programs that consumers like would be seriously disrupted. And I'd suggest that the definition of sale be defined in line with Virginia, or that this prohibition that I pointed to in 14.12-14 would be deleted. And ultimately, barring those sorts of arrangements completely is not pro-consumer, I think. Giving consumers choice and giving them the ability to opt out of for the use of the information may be appropriate, but to have a total bar is a very, very heavy regulatory push. A second thing that is in the bill that it goes beyond GDPR is the standard for consent. It would require consent for a narrowly defined specific purpose. That's not in GDPR. And the effect of that would be to require users to consent multiple times at once. They'd be shown a series of pop-ups to request their consent for each purpose. And that's cumbersome, even with regard to sensitive data, I think, and not appropriate. It's more like Taiwan's law on privacy, which is not enforced by the Taiwanese privacy regulator because it would be so cumbersome. I'd also point out that the flow example, Representative Elkins, that you cited would, I think, not be a problem because all processing, not just sale of personal data, requires consent. And the processing also includes disclosures. So users would need to consent to those other sorts of uses, and it would all be subject to an opt-in consent, therefore, because it's all part of processing. So for sensitive data, I don't think that the flow data problem that you mentioned would be a concern. Because consent works the way it works. Another issue that I think these are little tweaks overall. I think the bill is very good. That's worth paying or making some adjustments for relate to the service provider or controller processor requirements. There's some language in the Carlisle bill that gives the data controller, that's the business that hires the processor, the ability to impose an annual audit requirement on the processor. And if the processor doesn't want to let the controller that's hired them onto their premises, then the processor has to pay for that. Also, the controller has the ability to block any use of a subprocessor by the third party service provider by the processor. So for example, if the IT an auditor comes in and looks at the books of the an accounting firm that's hired, or an IT service provider comes in, the business that's the controller that hires them would have the ability to opt out of any access that entity would have to personal data. And I just think that it may make some sense in the context of a small business dealing with Amazon, for example, or some other entity that has a lot of bargaining power. But to put this in place also gives any business the ability to really run its processor through the ringer and impose very significant costs and hassles on that entity if they want to, if they're in some sort of dispute. And I think those provisions really should be moderated and be made more like the Virginia law. I think we're going to see some abuse of the Colorado law, which has something similar to this. So these are little things, but they're, I believe, quite important. Also, with regard to the regulatory structure, I with the exceptions which you referenced rightly, Representative Elkins, I think in particular the children's privacy exemption in the Virginia law, which I believe is the basis for the language here, doesn't quite work because the federal privacy law for children's privacy has other rights beyond parental consent, including access and correction and things like that. And really, there should be one regulatory regime. The Colorado law, I think, has a better, more developed exception that applies so that you don't have a conflicting state requirement and a conflicting federal requirement. These are details. I don't think the private right of action is a detail, and I think that that could well spell the real problem if that were added to the bill and it went over to the Senate. And for a variety of reasons, the private right of action, as you'll hear from my colleague Anton Bensaventer, is not a good fit for these highly operational privacy rights. So I suggest a point against adding that ultimately. Obviously, it's a political issue and it's going to move forward. But overall, I think this bill would be a major plus for consumers. I think that there are, with these little tweaks, ways to make this very workable for businesses without undermining protections for consumers. And very much appreciate your holding this hearing, and to the extent that I can be helpful in the future or answer any questions, I'd be delighted to. This issue is highly, highly technical, and I can tell you that the operational costs of complying with the California law are in the tens of billions of dollars. So getting this right is very important, but I think you're close. And with some of the tweaks that I mentioned, I think this could be a very helpful law for consumers and without causing serious disruption for Minnesota businesses in ways that really would be a win-win. So thank you very much. And again, very happy to answer questions, and apologies that my video isn't working. Thanks. Back to you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Halpert. The next testifier is Washington State Senator Bob Tennyson. Senator Tennyson. Senator Tennyson, I don't think we can hear you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tennyson is a retired Minnesota state senator.
Oh, my gosh. Misrepresented on my sheet here. I apologize. But we still can't hear you, sir. Why don't we try moving on to another testifier, and we'll see if we can get the audio straightened out there. Unless he's got it now. All right. While Mr. Tennyson works on his connection, we'll move to Tom Folks from the Software Alliance. Mr. Folks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, hopefully you can hear me. Members of the House Commerce Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act. My name is Tom Folks. I lead state advocacy efforts for BSA, the Software Alliance, representing the global software industry. Our members are business-to-business companies that create technology as well as privacy-protective products and services that other companies use, including cloud computing and workplace collaboration tools. These are all household company names that everyone's aware of. BSA strongly supports a comprehensive national framework that provides consumers with meaningful rights over their personal data and requires businesses to use that data in line with consumers' expectations. Very much in line with your earlier speakers. We're supportive of this effort. We've also very supportive of the important work of state legislatures to advance this conversation, including the legislation considered in Washington State earlier this year, as well as the laws enacted in Colorado and Virginia. Consumer privacy law will cover a broad range of different businesses, and BSA believes that any privacy law should impose strong obligations on all companies that handle consumer data. In particular, a privacy law needs to ensure that the rights given to consumers and the obligations placed on businesses function in a world where different types of companies play different roles in handling consumers' data. As currently proposed, the Minnesota Consumer Privacy Act does just that by creating strong obligations for both controllers and processors. This approach also aligns with the global standard embodied in privacy laws and voluntary frameworks worldwide. I will note, similar to some other concerns that were noted earlier, that BSA does have some minor suggestions to help improve language in this particular area. We'd be happy to work with Representative Elkins and others to accomplish that. I realize the committee will also consider the best way to enforce privacy law. We also strongly support enforcement by the Attorney General. While we believe all privacy laws should be strongly enforced, private right of action is not required for strong enforcement. So on behalf of BSA and our members, thank you for your thoughtful work on protecting consumer privacy and for your consideration of our perspectives. We would also be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Folks. I'm going to try Senator Tennyson again. Senator Tennyson? I can see your lips moving, but I'm not hearing any sound. So we will have to try to move on here. Next up testifier is Bruce Neustadt from the Minnesota Retailers Association. Mr. Neustadt.
Good morning, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. Thanks for having me today. As the chair said, my name is Bruce Neustadt. I work for the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a collection of innovative retailers across the state who serve Minnesotans in-store, online, as well as via curbside and delivery. About a third of our members have a national presence, about a third are regional or mid-sized retailers, and about a third are what you'd consider neighborhood retailers with one or more stores. First off, just a quick thank you to Representative Elkins for the numerous conversations over the past couple of years on his consumer data privacy bill. We know it's probably not an exaggeration to say Representative Elkins has had hundreds and hundreds of conversations on this bill, including many with retailers, and for that, we're grateful. Has been acknowledged by the author, this really is an issue that's far better legislated at the federal level, where a consistent standard could be crafted for all consumers. Based on how consumers purchase today, the consumer doesn't really need another confusing state-by-state approach where there's different requirements, different systems, and different processes in place. One important perspective to remember on this issue, as was pointed out kind of by Mr. Helpert earlier, is that consumers have expectations of their retailers and expect that we cater to their interests and needs, and data greatly helps with that. We see examples of this with customer loyalty and rewards programs, including couponing and deals and incentives. Today's consumer really expects that retailers provide some level of concierge service and that those products are available when and where desired. Convenience really is king for a Minnesota retailer, and a great example is delivery. Many retailers will use a third party for delivery or installation services. And in these cases, the consumer expects that end-to-end purchase process to be streamlined and easy without multiple opt-ins. In addition, as you've heard from many others already now on this issue, we're concerned about complexity and cost. Not every retail model would be impacted in a way that can be easily implemented for retailers here in Minnesota. Those concerns really are real. In an August of 2019 analysis by the State Department of California, Department of Justice and the Attorney General estimated that compliance costs with its law were likely to be $467 million to $16.4 billion over a 10-year period. That report identified specifically that companies with fewer than 20 employees had a staggering estimated cost of compliance at $50,000. And those costs are real and make a difference. So thank you for considering that as well. Just three quick wrap-up points today for you, Mr. Chair and committee. As other states have passed this consumer data privacy bill and are interested in when are working out the details, Minnesotans would be really well served by keenly observing what works and what doesn't when we look at consumer data privacy, and any Minnesota effort should really be aligned with other state standards as closely as possible. Secondarily, should this bill move forward, it really should not include a private right of action. Representative Elkins has been very clear that he sees that as an issue for the entire legislature. To us, as you've heard, enforcement with the state makes the most sense, and really having that single regulator makes it easier for consumers to understand their rights and creates a more certain and certainty for really the consumer and the business. And finally, as Representative Elkins has, it's imperative that we continue conversations on this. Just as retailers look to provide feedback to Representative Elkins, we offer that to all the committee members as well. We think the consumer-retailer relationships are really important to understand as it relates to this bill. So again, thank you, Representative Elkins. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your willingness to listen, and be happy to stand around for questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Neustadt. Our next testifier is Chris Oswald from the National Association of Advertisers. Mr. Oswald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, and members of the committee. I hope you can hear me okay. My name is Chris Oswald. I'm Senior Vice President for the Association of National Advertisers. We are the nation's oldest and largest Trade Association representing advertising and marketing, and we represent over 1,300 brand marketers as well as companies that cover the entire ecosystem. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm going to make three points, many of them you've heard before. First, in the absence of a national privacy approach, we think it's vital that states harmonize their legislative approach. This will help consumers have consistent privacy rights, and businesses, it will aid them to take a more holistic approach to privacy law compliance. And so we therefore urge this committee to align House File 1492 with recently enacted privacy legislation that other states have passed, specifically the Virginia Consumer Data Protection Act. Second, we ask that the committee maintains the current AG enforcement approach that's currently in the bill and refrain from adding a private right of action. We believe a private right of action would create a complex and flawed compliance system that would not bring any real tangible privacy benefits for Minnesotans. It would drive frivolous lawsuits and hurt innovation in Minnesota without doing anything really to aid consumer privacy. So we therefore ask the committee to keep the enforcement within the purview of the AG and the AG's office solely. Finally, we are concerned with some of the bill's broad opt-in consent requirements for certain demographic data. This approach, we believe, will impede consumers from receiving important information in a variety of contexts, and we ask the committee to modify the opt-in consent requirements so that it applies to demographic data only in cases where processing results in decisions that would bring legal effects concerning a consumer. Such data, when it's used for other purposes, would still be subject, of course, to the consumer rights that are provided in the bill. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. I'll simply say that we have submitted written testimony that goes through these points a little bit in more detail, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and the committee, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Elkins as this important bill moves forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Oswald. The next testifier is Tess Rice from the Minnesota Bankers Association.
Hi, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 95% of the banks in Minnesota, from the largest to the very smallest. We appreciate Representative Elkins' willingness to engage with us on this bill. We've been talking with him about this legislation for 2 or 3 years now, and our ask remains the same. We request a full exemption for financial institutions that are complying with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. This bill might seem long at 19 pages, but Congress has already established a comprehensive and lengthy privacy framework for banks. From the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act to its implementing Reg P and their interagency guidelines on safeguarding customer information, not to mention the other financial privacy laws like the Right to Financial Privacy Act. There's a robust financial privacy framework that's been in place for over 20 years. The Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act has two major consumer protections. First, it requires banks to have comprehensive information security programs to keep customer information safe. And second, it requires banks to inform and allow customers to opt out of sharing of their information. Most banks don't share customer information except to facilitate transactions, but if they do share with third parties, customers are notified and they have the opportunity to opt out of that sharing. What makes banks unique is not just that they're subject to this framework of laws. Every bank is examined regularly by a federal banking agency for their compliance with these laws. In fact, very large banks often have federal banking examiners permanently stationed on site to make sure they're complying. There's no other industry that has this type of intense regulatory scrutiny. This robust legal framework with the supervisory oversight is the reason that Colorado and Virginia have exempted banks from their privacy laws. In those states, compliance with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act is sufficient. There is an exception in this bill for personal data collected or processed pursuant to the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, and we appreciate that. But there's different definitions in the bills, or in the law in the bill, and the GLBA makes the scope of this intended exemption unclear for us. It is really awkward to try to work with both. The banks in Minnesota would very much appreciate the full exemption that was given in Colorado and Virginia so that they continue to protect their customer information under federal law without confusion and uncertainty. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with Representative Elkins in the future on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. The next testifier is John Reynolds from the Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Reynolds with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate Representative Elkins' outreach on this bill and our discussions about it, and I look forward to continuing to work with him. Above all, Minnesota businesses take their customers' privacy seriously. Safely and responsibly handling consumer data is critical to maintaining credibility and customer relationships. As others have mentioned, however, there are several broad concerns with the proposal I'd like to highlight. First, consumer data transactions regularly occur across borders, which makes this an issue that should be dealt with uniformly and most ideally at the federal level. A patchwork of differing state laws is confusing and costly for businesses and consumers. Of the three states with laws, as you've heard, Virginia's is regarded as the clearest and simplest with which to comply. As others mentioned, California has already undergone two significant revisions in 3 years, and Colorado's governor said when he signed their law earlier this year that a cleanup bill will be necessary in 2022. So a moving target. Second, businesses are concerned with how this proposal will affect compliance with existing laws, since it does not account for all potentially overlapping data regulations. Minnesota has a number of industry-specific data regulations, as well as data breach obligations that are not reconciled with this bill. And overlapping federal rights and remedies also exist, including enforcement action by the Federal Trade Commission, as exemplified in the Flow case raised earlier by Representative Elkins. Third, the cost to comply with this proposal is unknown, but one estimate from the California Attorney General's office projected initial compliance costs of $55 billion in their state. Despite significant costs to comply, early analysis from one data servicer in California shows pretty low consumer utilization. This suggests that model may neither be least cost nor most effective. So the further this bill deviates from a state like Virginia, the higher the incremental cost will be, in addition to those significant upfront compliance costs. Finally, as noted by others, we believe enforcement should be with a single entity rather than through multiple agencies or through the courts. Enforcement by a single entity, not through 10 different judicial districts, will result in more consistent outcomes and is the path chosen by Virginia and Colorado. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to comment. Representative Elkins, I look forward to continuing the conversation and continuing to work with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. The next testifier is Stephen Schneider from the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. Mr. Schneider.
Good morning, members of the committee and other guests. I work for the American Property Casualty Insurance Association based in Chicago. Our members write insurance all across the country. I'll be very brief, having already submitted a one-page statement on this, and would like to echo the comments that were made, particularly by Mr. Newstead and by Ms. Rice, and that is that insurers are already subject to an extensive privacy system, privacy network, regulation-type setup. We came forward with a privacy regulation system back in the 70s and 80s, and it's been enacted and adopted in all of the states and the District of Columbia, and it's been working very well. So it's very important to us that we are not subjected to a dual or second form of privacy regulation as this bill proposes. It would be helpful, however, as Ms. Rice said, because we too are governed by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, the federal law, that there be an exemption for entities which are governed under that statute. And that would make it clear and concise. But it doesn't remove the problems that a bill like this or a new law like this could present to our customers. And that's why we're also very, very concerned about the additional costs that this may put upon the backs of our customers, whether in retailing, whether in manufacturing, whether in service provision or what have you. And so we're very concerned about the impact for the possibility of double regulation when there doesn't seem to be a problem with respect to insurance privacy and how we've handled information. Yes, there have been a few hiccups here and there over the years, but for well over 40 years, insurers have handled private confidential information extremely well, and we're proud of that record. And having come forward to propose that, we were a part of it. We came forward with that type of proposal many years ago. We think it's functioned well and functions well in this new gig economy as well. So I'll stand down from there, but I appreciate the opportunity. And Representative Elkins, I know you've taken on a very complex and difficult subject here, and you should be saluted for taking on the subject. We just ask for some consideration on the points that I've outlined. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. The next testifier is Julia Decker from the American Civil Liberties Union. Ms. Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julia Decker, I'm the Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. ACLU of Minnesota has been engaged in this area of technology and data privacy at the legislature for a number of years, and we appreciate the opportunity to provide some brief testimony today. ACLU of Minnesota has significant concerns about this bill, which echo some of the main concerns that were raised by the ACLU of Washington regarding the Washington bill. First, there are provisions throughout the bill that lack enforcement mechanisms and leave definitions and compliance largely in the hands of data controllers themselves. Without meaningful oversight and enforcement, these standards for protecting consumers' data privacy really ring hollow. Second, provisions throughout the bill require consumers, this has been stated before, but require consumers to opt out of things such as data processing rather than giving consumers the right to opt in. And establishing a default position of everyone being subject to various data processing, sharing, and storage unless they opt out balances the equation away from privacy protection. Third, under this proposal, the local jurisdictions are preempted from enacting stronger privacy protections. This bill creates a ceiling rather than a floor when it should be the other way around. Local jurisdictions and the consumers who live there should have the ability to enact stronger privacy protections if they so desire. We acknowledge that data privacy is a complicated subject area, and even more so when we start looking at data being collected and maintained and used by third-party entities. We support proposals that generally further privacy protections for Minnesotans, but we urge this committee and the legislature to really carefully examine proposals such as HF 1492 to assess whether they really provide protection in name only. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. We have one more testifier, and then after that, we're going to try Senator Tennyson one last time, and then we will have member questions and comments. So the last testifier is Anton von Seventer of the State Privacy and Security Coalition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my name is Anton von Seventer, and I'm an attorney with DLA Piper in our administrative law practice group. And in that capacity, I'm counsel to the State Privacy and Security Coalition. And we're comprised of 29 major communications, technology, media, payment, retail companies, and six trade associations in these sectors. And so working on compliance with these types of laws that have been adopted in other states, we've really had the opportunity to test out the practical effects of variations in these state laws. And I want to emphasize that the variations in these laws and vague or unworkable provisions can be extremely costly without really materially advancing consumer privacy. So in this regard, I think I can add the most value today by briefly commenting on two important issues. First would be alignment with other state laws, as others have said, and second would be the private right of action. So first, for consistency, I think providing clarity to businesses and consumers is critical. And for this reason, we really request that at least the core provisions of the bill be substantively aligned with other state consumer privacy laws. So HF 1492 would grant Minnesota consumers essentially many of the same rights as in other state privacy laws. So there's no upside to the misinterpretation and potential confusion that can be caused by dramatic departures. And this also applies to the need for clear exemptions, such as for entities and data, as we've heard, regulated by Gramm-Leach-Bliley, as well as an exemption for compliance with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Aligning these provisions would avoid inconsistent and confusing application of Minnesota's law to businesses that are really already otherwise regulated. So secondly, for the private right of action, we understand that there's some chance that a private right of action may be added to the bill in the Judiciary Committee. But it's important to understand that PRAs for alleged privacy violations just involve, as a practical matter, highly asymmetrical costs because drafting and filing a complaint can enable plaintiffs' lawyers to impose disruptive e-discovery into a business's highly operationally technical data operations. And defending non-meritorious cases typically cost between $500,000 to $1 million to the company without the plaintiff's bar law firm incurring any material expense. And furthermore, you know, we share the committee's goal of protecting consumers, but recent studies have proven that PRAs do really little to compensate these consumers for privacy intrusions, even when violations have been shown, and that instead government enforcers, particularly state attorneys general, are really far better equipped for this. So I thank the committee very much again for your time and look forward to continuing to develop the language in this bill.
Thank you. We'll try Senator Tennyson one last time. Senator Tennyson?
Can you hear me now?
I can. Wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I want to commend Representative Elkins for undertaking this daunting task. And also members of the committee, I'm sure by now you all feel like you're in the deep end of the pool and trying to figure out what the principles are and how you should address this. And all I can say is that I suggest you go back and look at the Fair Information Practice Principles that were developed in 1973 by the ATW Committee that was put in by Elliot Richardson, and it developed the Fair Information Practice Principles, which always acts in some way implicated. And just in a summary, here's what they are. There must be no personal data record keeping the systems which are, the existence of which is secret. There must be a way for individuals to find out what information about them and how it is used. There must be a way for individuals to prevent information about them obtained for one purpose from being used for another without their consent. There must be a way for individuals to correct and amend records. And then lastly, it imposes on the organization an obligation to make sure that the information collected is correct and accurate and that it's not an issue. The reason Steve asked me to testify is because the Uniform Law Commission, which I'm a member, developed a Uniform Act. And I agree with all the previous speakers that this is really a national problem. In fact, it's an international problem, and having state laws on this is very complicated for everybody, the consumer and the industry that's affected by it. Ideally, Congress would act, but that isn't likely to happen for reasons that you see right here. The Uniform Law Conference undertook this project a few years ago, first with the study committee, and decide whether or not to recommend that we go forward with the committee to draft a Uniform Act. It was a close vote committee. We went forward with the drafting. And our drafting process is, as some of you may know, it runs at least 2 years. And we, commissioners are appointed, we have a reporter, we have a formal relationship with various bar association appoint participants. And then we also seek out observers, people who have an interest, organizations that have an interest in the topic. We had several meetings, we had 120 observers. Every industry that you think of was there, including some of the people who testified today before you. It's a complicated issue. That's why you get lost in the details immediately as soon as you start trying to do this. I'm not going to do a comparison of the Uniform Act with the other acts that that have been referenced. So let me just say that there are a few things about the Uniform Act that are helpful. One, it authorized all data practices called compatible data practices that may be performed without consent. It develops some new concepts. And the second one is it prohibits data practices that may cause a substantial risk of harm to data subjects, including processing, likely to cause embarrassment, harassment, financial harm, and data storage that fails to provide reasonable security. It does permit incompatible data practices, that is, processing that is neither compatible nor prohibited, to be performed but only with notice and consent. It promotes transparency and accountability by requiring companies to post a privacy notice identifying the issues of personal data use that identifying the use of personal data, and by giving data subjects the right to access to correct data, it avoids the what some people consider a substantial First Amendment conflict associated with the right to delete data. It authorizes personal data to be used for tailored messages, including advertising, as a compatible use. This provision does not cover the use of personal data to make tailored decisions about the terms of an offer to agreement with or treatment of an individual. And it requires businesses to engage in privacy and security assessments, self-assessments, and encourages honest self-reflection by shielding the contents of the self-assessment from disclosure and subsequent litigation. Allows businesses to avoid the cost of multiple compliance procedures by recognizing compliance with similar and more restrictive laws for which the jurisdiction from other jurisdictions has compliance with this act. Limits the scope of the act to companies that collect non-public information or data maintained in a system of records designed for individual treatment of or communication with data subjects, thus avoiding the applicability to unstructured forms of information such as email communications. It exempts data processing that is already regulated by federal privacy regimes. And he referenced those witnesses testified about that, the members lobby and others. it encourages the development of, this is a new thing, it develops encouragement, voluntary consensus standards by which data controllers, processors, data subjects, and other interested parties can engage together to develop standards tailored to the context of particular industries. There's a lot behind that, and it's not, I would encourage you, if you're interested, to look at the OMB circular that created this first place. It incorporates enforcement provisions of the existing State Consumer Protection Act that authorizes the State's Attorney General to monitor personal data practices. I mean, so Minnesota has a Consumer Protection Act and that would be the enforcement provisions. It encourages uniformity of enforcement in the enacting states by authorizing Attorney General directly or through the National Association of Attorney Generals to coordinate the regulatory enforcement policies. And it encourages states to determine for themselves whether a private right of action should be authorized for the violation of the act, and provides practical language to prohibit such action. That's generally what it does. Be happy to provide any more information you want, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Senator. We will now move to member questions and discussion. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins, for your bill. My question is, how do we measure success here? And I think in order to do that, I'm not sure that we've defined the problem we're trying to solve. So how do we measure success? Because as has been stated here earlier, there's a modest cost to the state, a modest cost to the AG's office, but this is a considerable cost to our business partners in Minnesota for the cost of compliance. So how do we ensure that we're getting at what we want to get at, least cost, least burdensome, and most efficient for those business partners?
Representative Elkins.
Sure. So I think that's, and just about all of the testifiers today have stressed the importance of making sure that the law that we passed is as well aligned with what's already passed in other states as possible in order to minimize the incremental costs. A goal of mine would be to minimize or eliminate any implementation costs as a result of the passage of this act. Beyond that, which the businesses are already going to have to incur in order to comply with these similar laws in other states. Speaking with the large Minnesota companies, especially the retailers like Target, all of these companies do business in California already. They're already incurring these costs. In many cases, they're already extending these rights to residents of other states simply because it's more expensive to do state-by-state carve-outs from the rights granted in the California bill than it is to just grant those rights to residents of other states as well. But certainly minimizing the incremental cost to California businesses from the implementation of a bill along these lines is one of my key objectives.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Farr?
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I have a number of questions, so if I can get a couple off, and I know my colleagues also have additional thoughts. Can you tell us, Representative Elkins, in your research, how many businesses you feel will be impacted by your new bill?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Representative Haley and Mr. Chair. No, I have not counted them, but there is a size limit in the bill that should exclude pretty much all small businesses. I will say that over time, what I expect will happen is that because most small businesses
actually run on software provided by large national software vendors in terms of things like their point of sale systems, their customer management systems. I do think that over time, as those basic capabilities get built into these national software packages that the small businesses use, they will over time gain the capability to serve their customers the way large companies do as well at minimal cost.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, do you have an additional description of how do you characterize a small business in your bill other than the, I think it was 25,000?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, it is spelled out exactly in the bill. It's the same definition that is used in, for the most part, in the other state bills as well. I think there may be one of the states that it's slightly different, but that baseline is consistent in pretty much all of these state bills.
Representative Haley, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, I'm also wondering, I know you've spent a lot of time on this, in talking to businesses, are there a number of businesses in the state of Minnesota that are already providing these types of protections for consumers' data? Clearly, privacy is a main concern, and I think most businesses want to do the right thing because it protects the trust that they have with their customers, and those ongoing relationships are important to business stability and growth. So give me a sense for a number of businesses in Minnesota that maybe already are providing this without additional regulation.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Haley. Yes, certainly any Minnesota-based business that is doing business in Europe or California, looking forward, certainly at this point already, Colorado and Virginia, speaking with representatives of companies like Target, for example, they are already implementing these protections. For their customers nationwide. So I think that most Minnesota businesses who are bound to observing either the European law or the California law are already taking those steps.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just in closing, Representative Elkins, I really feel like I need more information from you on just the scope of the impact here. And I appreciate your answers to my questions, but I'm still not comfortable that we understand how many businesses this will affect. Not every business in Minnesota is like an Amazon or a Target. So we've got a breadth of size and scope of businesses in Minnesota. And so I think before any additional work from the committee on this or the legislature, we really need to know who we're impacting. So I would encourage you to help us, understand that and bring us some data on that. And then in closing, earlier you mentioned that there was a House research comparison of your bill, and I believe Virginia's and Colorado's. I did not see that in the committee documents. Yeah. Is that something that you can share with us after the hearing?
Representative Elkins, if you could provide that to Ms. Miller, we'll get to the committee.
So right now it's in the form of an email from to me from Nathan Hopkins and House Research. It's informal at this point. He had done a quick review and found very few differences. But I can forward that email to you. Plus, I know that the Future Privacy Forum has prepared a detailed analysis as well. It has not yet been published. And I believe that the International Association of Privacy Professionals is doing similar analysis right now. So I will provide all of that information to everyone. In fact, I've collected a bunch of links to other information related to the bill that went out to people who are on the stakeholder list. And that same information was sent to Lita O'Driscoll and a few other House members who have indicated a strong interest in this subject, and I can forward that information to you as well. But I intend to do is put together a comprehensive list of all of the reference sources that I found useful, and I will make that list of resources available to everyone. Also, I have offered Lita O'Driscoll that any member of the House Republican Caucus who wants to sit down with me either one-on-one or as part of a small group to go through the bill and answer questions in detail. I'm otherwise retired. This is what I'm doing right now, and I would be happy to do the same with you as well. I had a very nice long conversation with Representative Lucero at the Privacy Summit over a beer in the evening at the hotel in Alexandria, and I would be happy to do the same with you or any other member of the committee.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to ask a number of questions. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. While I did not have a beer or scotch, I definitely found it intriguing, the details of some of the history of scotch there that we I do have, Mr. Chair, a number of questions and comments that are going to take us past the time allotted, so I'm not going to go into incredible detail because there is an opportunity for obviously this evolving piece of legislation and conversation. But I will open with saying this. In my entire time in office here, being in my fourth term, I have been one of the champions of data privacy and that topic. And so it is incredibly important to me the answer to the following question, that is, who owns the data? Whether it be your first name, last name, date of birth, or other sensitive information, PII, or whether it be the product of data mining and profiling, who owns that information? And I think in my time, I think it's pretty clear where I fall on that side, and that is the individual owns that information. But at the same time, as being a small business owner myself, and one who interfaces with many businesses, small and large, I'm also very sensitive to the burdensome cost that can be placed on business when trying to protect that data and enact new pieces of legislation and requirements, such as the bill before us. So with that, I guess the first question that I would have, Representative Elkins, is as we've discussed, we have some history here in the states here. So California, Colorado, and Virginia. Can you tell us what the enactment of those bills that have passed so far in the states?
Representative Elkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero. The California Privacy Rights Act, the Virginia bill, the Colorado bill, all become effective on January 1st, 2023. In this bill, as it's written right now, the enactment date is in there as July 1st, 2022. It would be my intention to, when we come back in January, to align the effective date of this bill with the effective dates of the CPRA, the Virginia bill, the Colorado bill. That seems to be the common implementation dates for these bills, and that's one area where I would like us to be consistent with the other states.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. And I think that's important that we understand that, because we've had heard with some of the testifiers the citations of the expected costs to implement some of this, but we, knowing that nothing has been enacted yet, we don't have any true, real, hard numbers yet. And as we're considering the decisions and requirements for this legislation, it's just important for us to keep in mind that nothing has been fully enacted yet by the industry or by the companies that will be in scope, I should say, as those numbers continue to tally.
Yeah, Mr. Representative Lucero, it's real
Elkins.
On that, if I can. So the expenses which are being incurred right now by businesses around the country are largely pursuant to the enactment of the California Consumer Privacy Act a couple of years ago. By all accounts, that bill was, well, you know, I spoke with Jackie Irwin, who was one of the authors of that bill at the conference last week, and she said, yeah, you know, we had a week to put that bill together in order to head off an even more poorly written initiative and referendum in California. Just that the bill was so badly written that it has spawned, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of lawsuits. It's been a nightmare to implement. And that's basically why other states are not using the CCPA as a template. The reason that we've all gravitated to the general framework created by Senator Carlisle in Washington is that while it grants many of the same rights, the bill itself is just much better written, with much more stakeholder input, and so. To the extent that and costs are being incurred right now, they're being incurred pursuant to the requirements of the currently active CCPA in California. With the additional clarity that's provided in these Washington-based bills, I would look at the costs that are being incurred under CCPA as kind of a worst-case scenario.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. In the next question that we have is, when we were looking at the conference, or when we were in the conference last week, we saw several examples of legislation that's moving in other states, not even necessarily this legislation, but other related legislation as well, that it all enjoyed one thing in common, that it was a strong bipartisanship sponsorship. So even in those states where they were fully controlled by one party or the other, we had up on the panel co-authors, either in the same body or in respective bodies, that were both champions of the legislation. So in this case, Minnesota here, can you just give us some background who your co-authors are in the House and then in the Senate companion? And then part B of that question is, what do you see as the path forward into next year on this bill?
Yeah. Representative Elkins.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero. So in the COVID era, it's been, very difficult to, take a bill and walk it around the halls. And I really haven't undertaken much of an effort to attract, co-authors on this bill. But as you know, I have been, very actively engaged with the GOP members in the House that are strong privacy advocates, including yourself, Representative Scott, Representative of Nash. And I would hope that you guys, I can get you to where you're comfortable to be sign on as co-authors as well. Same thing in the Senate, in terms of reaching across the aisle in the Senate. I'm actively, trying to work with Senator Coran and the key chair over there, Senator Matthews, to get them on board. And I will continue to do that. There's no reason, this should not be a bipartisan bill, as you're observing. In other states, much the same legislation is passing with overwhelming bipartisan support. I tend to avoid, trying to legislate in areas that are highly partisan. This is not one yet. And as I move forward with this bill, I hope to be able to win over you and your colleagues and Republican senators as well. There's no reason why this should be a partisan bill.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are quickly running out of time. And as I said, I have way more on here that we just have a lot for. So I'll just make a few comments here without trying to form them in the shape of a question. And maybe Representative Elkins could nod, or we can go on.
Yeah, Representative Sarah, reach out to me.
We are, as you know, running low on time. So I appreciate you being cognizant of that. I do want to give Representative Elkins the chance for a last word. So if you could take a couple of minutes here and then.
Sure, yeah. So I'll just some generalized comments. The definitions, obviously, I've gone through. I'm not going to pick them apart here, but I have highlights and stuff. There's much room for opportunity to improve the definitions, to narrow them down, to become more clear in various areas. And some of the areas I'm seeing conflict. But again, that's just the product of legislation from other states being translated into Minnesota statute, things like that. So there's room in there. One that I'll draw out that I think is interesting. So in regards to the actions that can take place by the consumer, and that is they can update, delete, and there's a few other actions. But one of them I found interesting was to port. And I would be interested, not now, but we can hear this. Why would a company be expected to export any data they have on the consumer in a format that can be transmitted to a potential competitor, right? That one is an interesting action. And just for reference, that I saw that on lines 9.19 through 9.22, and then again on 12.1. In regards to on line 15.18, there is the risk assessment or vulnerability assessment that is needed to be performed. And then upon the request of the Attorney General, it would have to be turned over. I'm not entirely sure, maybe there's some examples, but I'm not immediately familiar with examples where a risk assessment, very, very confidential and potentially sensitive information on a company and their technology systems would have to be turned over to government just upon request. And that's very concerning to me. The e-discovery costs, I think one of the testifiers alluded to it, and we did hear one of our speakers where a company or somebody that may want to abuse a company can file a lawsuit and incur generally a cost of about $25,000. And if a lawsuit, the testifier at the conference was saying, if it's well-written, a complaint can then kick off an e-discovery process that the company then is obligated to incur $500,000 to $1 million. And so on the one side, you have the plaintiff or the complainant, $25,000 is theirs, but in order to maybe punish a private company, could incur $500,000 to $1 million. It's a concern. And then the last thing I want to say, Mr. Chair, in regards to the Attorney General, I heard allusions to, what were the terms? Rulemaking and enforcement or to rulemaking. Boy, in no means do I, and I know I share the opinion of a lot of people, would we ever want to turn that authority over to the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, to create rules, because there are many of us that are very concerned with Attorney General Ellison with the perception of being just radical and having endorsed violent groups like Antifa. I'm very concerned with him or somebody like him being in a capacity to punish businesses. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. We have just a couple of minutes left. This, as I mentioned, was an informational hearing, so we're not going to take any formal action today, but I will give Representative Elkins, if you could just take a minute or 90 seconds to wrap up here.
Yep, very, very quickly. I take no actual pride of authorship for this bill whatsoever. 100% of the work to this point has been either done by Senator Carlisle and his staff, or Washington, or Nathan Hopkins in House Research. The task I gave him at the very beginning of this year was, as soon as Senator Carlisle has introduced his bill in Washington, grab the text and Minnesotaize it by Mitch. I meant take off the long preambles that are customary in Washington, not here. Change all of the references to in Washington state law to references to Minnesota state law, and that's pretty much it. So that's the starting point. But we received a lot of feedback, good feedback today. Most of it reinforces feedback that I've already been receiving from stakeholders along the way. And so between now and January 31st, I'll be having continuing meetings with other legislators and stakeholders first of all, better align the bill with updates to the language that have occurred in Colorado and Virginia. Getting this ready to be formally introduced as amended in January. So my door is open. This is one of my most important initiatives. Anyone who wants to meet with me and talk with me, offer suggestions, is welcome to reach out to me directly between now and then, so that we can get this bill into shape to be passed early in the 2022 session. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Elkins, for taking on this Herculean task here and putting a lot of effort into it very clearly. We all, I think, appreciate that. And it seems like there's a fair amount of work left to do, so I'm sure you'll put your back into it and keep going. Thank you, members of the committee, for joining us for this hearing today. And with that, the committee is adjourned.